So here's a summary of what I'm going to talk about in a form which is probably not comprehensible to a lot of you, but I'm giving you an outline, and I'm going to explain most of this. The important point is what's said at the top. When you compactify, you know that you get G2 manifolds, maybe, and if you do, you can do some physics on them or from them, but they don't come alone. So because it's compactifications, you get hidden sectors. And what I'm going to argue, or what I'm going to point out, is that hidden sectors lead to some very important physics. And if you ignore hidden sectors and their connections to the manifolds, you could miss out on that important physics and not get, in particular, the vacuum structure right. So, yes, I'm going to. It's all coming. This is what to watch for. So I'll tell you about hidden sectors. There are several major things that happen. One is that it's been known for a long time, and anybody who's taught a course or taken a course about supersymmetry knows that you can't break supersymmetry in the visible sector. I'll tell you what the visible sector is. You have to have hidden sectors, and that's usually just sort of passed over, and you break supersymmetry in the hidden sector and transmit it somehow. But maybe arguably the most important point is that hidden sector matter leads to having a de Sitter vacuum rather than ADS. And that's a controversial subject these days, as you know, and I'll say a little bit about where it comes from. Then I won't talk about this. I've heard several people say it's necessary for mathematical consistency, but I can't give you a proper quote. I'll let you supply that. And then I'll talk a little bit about dark matter, because hidden sectors certainly supply candidates for the dark matter of the universe. So we want to study them. Hidden sectors are sectors which have particles, and the particles don't have any standard model charges, so at tree level they don't interact with any of the standard model stuff. You can't produce them from beams or decays of any of the weak electromagnetic or QCD forces. They will have tree diagram, for example. I mean, they will have loop diagram connections and such things, but we won't go into that much detail here. The visible sector is the one that underwent inflation of three large dimensions, and we live in. And you can tell that it underwent inflation. So what you can think of about what I'm talking about is what can be done if all the manifolds and metrics exist that you're talking about. We assume they exist, and go ahead. Historically, I want to start sort of at the beginning so you see the point a little bit. Historically, you know, the goal is to understand the world we perceive. And to do that, a minimum of three things is crucial. One is that you have to know what the particles that we're made of are, and we know the answer. They're quarks and electrons and other particles like electrons, but they don't matter for us. And those are chiral fermions. I think you all know what chiral is formally. It's the weird thing that particles that are left-handed moving in the direction of the spin pointing in the direction of the momentum interact differently from right-handed ones. Then we need to know what the forces are that have these particles get into forms that are like our world. And what's called the standard model is these first two things, the particles and the forces that have been discovered in the second half of the last century. Then there's a set of rules to calculate what happens. Those are relativistic quantum field theories. And they work for any forces in particles, but in particular, they work for these forces in particles. We really want all the forces in a comprehensive package, including general relativity in some form, and that's the idea of starting in something like an 11-dimensional M theory that includes relativity, GR, and compactifying down to a world that has the standard model and GR. Since the mid-1980s, you know that we expect that world to have 10 or 11 space dimensions, and starting with M theory with 10 is well motivated there. And the compactified or Stringer M theory then seems like a very good candidate to try and make a theory which you could say would turn into a model by the time you make a couple of assumptions, but it's basically a theory for our world. And then you see that you write down a potential and you minimize it and you find a vacuum state, and we live in the ground state of such a theory.
What do you mean we live in the vacuum? What do you mean we live in the vacuum?
The vacuum is, you write down the potential energy of the whole theory and you minimize it, and the different, oh, let me come to the sectors before I fully answer that, okay? So if we focus on M theory for what we're doing, and it could be that you could focus on a different kind of compactification, but there's been a lot of work on M theory. In particular, Bobby and I have worked on it a lot and have a lot of results that make it easy to do this. And he also has a very good picture that is useful. So you all know Witten wrote something. Then soon after Witten, a very important paper by Papadopoulos and Townsend showed that when you compactify M theory on a singular seven-dimensional G2 manifold, assuming one exists, and it has G2 holonomy, and then it preserves an equal one supersymmetry. So the four-dimensional theory that you get is a relativistic quantum field theory, and it's got an equal one supersymmetry. The forces come from papers that Bobby started. Non-abelian gauge fields are localized on three-dimensional submanifolds, along which there's some orbifold singularity, for example. And there's a long path of stuff, but in particular, the original papers are these. And that's what we mean by the vacuum, in the sense that those sectors have gauge matter and forces and Yang-Mills forces, and you can, on the surfaces of things, you'll get chirofermions, as it'll say in a minute. So the particles come from chiral conical singularities on the surfaces of things. And so you have all the ingredients you need for the standard model of forces and particles and theory, and you can make a complete theory out of this. And then you can calculate the energy and see that you minimize the vacuum, and you'll see that you get a de Sitter vacuum when you do that. So it's known in the courses that you can write a fully, if you take that supersymmetric relativistic 4D theory, and you have to give three functions, one called a superpotential, one a Kähler potential, and one a gauge kinetic function, to calculate things. Moduli are crucial. You have to stabilize all the moduli, or physics would change. The laws of nature would change if they weren't stabilized, because the coupling strengths and such things depend on moduli. You find then that the moduli will be complex, the imaginary parts will be axions and the real parts scalars. You can interpret them in terms of the theory if you want. And then a crucial point is that the axions have a shift symmetry, and that can only be broken by non-perturbative pieces. So the superpotential has to be entirely non-perturbative, and that's a major constraint in constructing a theory. We have to stabilize moduli. They get vacuum expectation values. So here's a series of papers, not all of which could have been longer, but we'll stop with this. And what I'm going to do is briefly talk about some of those. If I tried to go through and derive all the things and explain the things, it would take far too long, but I'll tell you why they're there. The first two papers have the titles here. This is papers written by Bobby and or myself and students and postdocs that I won't list now. So the first two you can see, 2006 and 7, they stabilized all the moduli and those broke supersymmetry, calculated the supersymmetry breaking Lagrangian fully. We showed that they had a generic Higgs mechanism, and I had it before the LHC data, we could write down the value of M Higgs over MZ. We show that there were some superpartner masses expected in the TEV region, the Gaginos, the Gluino and Chargino and Bino should be in the TEV region, and the others will be heavier. And we know how much, like 40 TEV, we know how much heavier. But there's a Higgs mechanism. Bobby and collaborators wrote down an axion detailed solution and showed there was an axion solving the strong CP problem. If you don't know what those problems are, it doesn't matter, but they solve something important. I mention electric dipole moment small because it's an example of how you find when you calculate things some surprises that could be very important. So it's been for 20 years a puzzle in supersymmetry why supersymmetry seemed to predict electric dipole moments of electrons and neutrons that were large, and experiments weren't finding them. In fact, it's very simple here. At the high scale, all the terms in the superpotential have to have the same phase. You can calculate, we have a paper, and then you can rotate it away. So there's no electric dipole moments at all at the high scale. Then the renormalization group running to the low scale where we live is under control. You know exactly how to calculate the predicted ones. And the prediction is still about a factor of 20 below recent data that was said to completely eliminate supersymmetry because it predicted big phases, but we didn't. And we did this long before the experiments. So it's an example of how if you actually go in and calculate stuff, and it doesn't depend on the details of the phases, it just depends on the details of the metric or the manifolds, it depends on comparing a set that have to be the same. And then I think I'll have time to talk briefly about a new thing we did. A very smart postdoc at Stockholm, Martin Winkler, and I were able to figure out what the inflaton is in the compactified M theory and identify it physically. And then we'll be able to study various things with it. I'm going to go through now some go through some slides showing calculations so you actually believe we calculate things and see the formulas. It would, again, take forever to derive them, so I'll just be brief. The non-perturbative superpotential is a sum of terms like this with the gauge kinetic function in the exponent there. And the gauge kinetic function was shown by Lukas and Morris to be an integer combination of the moduli, the complex moduli, with integer phases. In practice, the formulas I mostly show you will come by assuming an approximation where we just use two terms, because then we can get things where we can look at it, the formulas, and interpret things and make sense of it. In practice, we also did numerical work because you could have a larger sum of these things. And there are terms like the dual Coxeter numbers and an N for SUN. And we use the well-motivated approximation that the two sectors have the same one here, but we can do different ones numerically. Then you need to write out a Kähler potential. The Kähler potential was written by Beasley and Witten first and then improved by Acharya and collaborators. And it's got some very particular features, like having that sum of rational numbers be 7/3 in the volume. It only depends on the moduli through the volume, not other ways. This is a generic one. We include charged matter in the Hinn sector this way. It was following a method first worked on by Seiberg and then improved by a lot of people over time. But basically, you put in the Hinn sector matter, quark states Q and their superpartners, and the way they transform, and you put it in a form like this. Again, we'll do the formulas to keep them simple, but we include lots more families and families in different sectors and so forth. You make a meson, which is the product of these guys. So, and in the ground state, it'll be phi zero, and the phase will turn out to be zero. So you'll see phi in the formulas like here. And you can track back these from the gauge groups Q and P. I'll use that once more in a little while. So you get a big scalar potential. And you want to minimize that scalar potential, which we do. You have to have smart collaborators to do that. But I'm just showing you it to show you that it's there. The first problem that we solve, or the biggest one in some sense, is the hierarchy problem. That is by most people considered the central problem in particle physics today. It's the problem that there are two scales in the world, the Planck scale formed by the fundamental constants, which is around 10 to the 19 GeV, you know, and the electroweak scale, which is around 100 GeV, and is where the Higgs bosons and the Z and W and so forth are. First, such a huge separation wouldn't be stable in a quantum field theory. From the Higgs mass and from other things, the scales would not stay apart. Second, what is the origin of the actual values of the second scale? And those are the problem. We do get a solution of that. One point that's interesting about compactifying M theory, and you might find other things in other theories, but you don't in some of them. If you go, you can set the value of the cosmological constant to be zero at the minimum by choosing this condition where, remember, Qs and Ps were related to the ranks of the groups. So the details don't matter, but you can do it. When you do that, first you can check that your things you calculate are not sensitive to what happens if you change it, but you get a surprising result. That the gravitino mass is around 50 TeV. Gravitino is the superpartner of the graviton, and gravitino would be zero mass if you didn't have supersymmetry breaking. So this is a measure of supersymmetry breaking from the low scale. But what we find is you don't need to separately set the cosmological constant zero and the gravitino mass to be here to get a workable world that comes for free. And we think that's an important thing that you get by, again, just calculating and doing things. So the hierarchy problem is solved by this approach. Here's just a list of results that don't depend much on knowing the details of the manifolds. There are lots of other results that do, but these don't. So you're able to show gravity mediation of the supersymmetry breaking. Bobby has always had this nice argument where you have three cycles floating around in a seven-dimensional space and they can't find each other, so they can only interact gravitationally, and that proves it. You can stabilize all the moduli without knowing the details. We could go through it, but we don't have time. You get the physics of the electroweak symmetry breaking, which is really important. As I mentioned, you find small EDMs. We find a solution to the inflation problem. So those are things where you actually solve something or get something. Then we have some predictions. We predict the lightest superpartner will decay to hidden sector matter always. Basically, the argument is that the lightest superpartner in the visible sector will always be heavier than some hidden sector matter when you have hundreds of hidden sector states. And there are what are called kinetic mixing operators that connect any two sectors if one of them is ours and the other has any kind of cage matter in it. Then you can form a dimension four Lagrangian, and that Lagrangian won't get suppressed by powers of mass, so it'll connect things in you. The commonly made argument that all of us made for years, but turns out to be wrong in compactified string theories, is this guy won't be a dark matter candidate, but the hidden sectors will supply dark matter candidates. It's not that things are gone. I mentioned the gravitino mass is around 40 TeV, but the gauginos are light, the gluino and the partners of the gauge particles of the standard model. They're of order 1 TeV, half a TeV, 2 TeV, that kind of thing. They're in the region where they should be at LHC. The one that's most detectable is the gluino, the partner of the gluon, because it has feel strong interactions, color force, so it's produced more. And one of the things that we learn is that it shouldn't be lighter than about 1.5 TeV. We can't, it could be heavier somewhat, but we don't get it lighter here, and that's actually true in other corners of compactifications as well. So we should never have expected to see an LHC particle lighter than about 1.5 TeV if we take models that satisfy all the conditions and compactify them. The data right now excludes about 1.7 or 1.8 TeV and below, but 1.5 was the lower bound in the sense it could be 2 TeV. Which is not excluded, for example. So LHC should produce stuff. But we can't, and the calculations are not more precise than that at this stage. They could be done better, but not yet. Now I want to mention the three things that arise from hidden sectors. So I mentioned the dark matter, and there's a number of papers that look at possible candidates. The point is that some hidden sectors will have stable matter for maybe for accidental reasons. They'll have matter on it, and the matter might be from glue ball type things or chiral fermion type things, but there will be some in general. Given it, you can compute its Rayleigh density. We know how, and we've done that for a number of cases. And you find cases that could be the dark matter. Maybe there are several contributions. So hidden sectors can supply the dark matter. Second, here's in a little more detail the argument about the vacuum, which was first appearing in the papers that Bobby and I worked on in 2007. In the last couple of years, if you ask for title de sitter, you get about 600 papers for unclear reasons from what I'm looking at. So you calculate the scalar potential. The scalar potential is a sum of what are called F terms that are just derivatives of superpotential terms. So you have superpotentials. You take the derivatives with respect to different parts of the physics. You subtract the important part that comes from the rest of the system. And a scalar potential, which is positive, is a de Sitter minimum. But if you drop the hidden sector matter term and you just have this stuff, then the scalar potential is indeed negative, and you get an anti-de Sitter vacuum and you have a problem. And people have looked at a lot of approaches to that issue, but this approach seems satisfactory. So if you don't include the hidden sectors, you're not going to find the right kind of vacuum. And you'd be misled by a lot of your considerations. Third, I mentioned it's the old supersymmetry breaking argument. Basically, you know what supersymmetry is. There are some rules you can write that basically come from keeping some integrals finite. And the sum rules involve things like the squarks minus the fermions. And they would be zero if the supersymmetry weren't broken, this difference. But when it's broken, the squarks are heavy. They are not yet seen. Presumably, they're in tens of TeV from the theory. So you could never satisfy that. On the other hand, you can break the supersymmetry easily in hidden sectors with things like Gugino condensations and other things. And then the information gets transmitted by gravitational interactions, which you can write in your Lagrangian, and you get entirely satisfactory supersymmetry breaking. Now let me just describe briefly the inflation. Again, if I were to go through all the derivations, it would not be very helpful, I think. So here in words is more or less in the abstract of what happens. We take the compactified Hem theory. It contains, we find, a successful inflaton. The inflaton is simply a linear combination of moduli. The moduli are stabilized. We know their masses in the theory, and we know their interactions. We write down and look at linear combinations, and we find one that corresponds closely to the overall volume modulus of the manifold, so the compactified region. Physically, we probably should have thought of that right from the beginning, but we had to work it out first and obtain it. So I'm just going to show you a couple of graphs about what happens in the inflation. Here's actually the potential. So you take the linear combination of moduli that corresponds approximately to the overall volume modulus. So you've got a formula for those. And then you actually calculate the potential energy. And here's what it looks like. Rho is the inflaton mass. And here's the potential depth. Ignore the fact that there are two. It's to show that one of them does inflate and the other doesn't, and you have to really pay attention to know what you're doing. But what's interesting is that the potential energy has, this is the flat region that corresponds to inflation being flat, and the dot occurs where there's an inflection point, which affects the analysis and the physics you get out. Here's something that's very interesting, if you haven't looked at these things. Here's the masses of particles. The left-hand column is the masses of particles in the vacuum, and the right-hand is the masses of the particles during inflation. So first, the Higgs is this stark line here, which is up there, way heavy during inflation. But here it's down, you can't even see it down here because it's 125 GeV. So the Higgs is very differently behaving during inflation. And then the ones I emphasized were the gravitino. Whoops. The gravitino here during, in the vacuum, is what I told you about. It's a number of tens of TeV. It's not exactly the same in the inflationary calculation as in the rest of the M-theory stuff we did, because we made somewhat simplified models for this, but it's qualitatively the same. But during inflation, the gravitino mass jumps up to way above, sort of around 10 to the 8 or 9 TeV. And that's physically the way things will behave. And then at the end of inflation, the you drop back to the vacuum values at the end of inflation, and you have a set of moduli, all three or four of which dominate, and you can start calculating the properties of the Big Bang from the end of inflation, which we haven't had time to do yet. So I want to emphasize, we only input the Planck scale in this. We didn't input any other parameter or physics. We simply use generic Kähler potential, generic gauge kinetic function, as calculated by people at the beginning of the 2000s. And the superpotential that obeyed the shift symmetry rules. We get out. Scale of inflation should be high. This is R is in that community a well-known ratio of scalar to tensor modes, and it should be very small. Gauginos are predicted to be a few TeV, as I said, Higgs mass. These scales all come out, the electroweak scale, just by using the compactified M theory and calculating and taking it seriously. And you get a nice set of stuff, and so far no disagreements with experiment, or no theory problems. So I think it is probably important to look at the hidden sectors a lot. If, I can alert you to the next coming piece of data that is relevant. There's a thing called the G minus 2 of the muon, the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. And there was an experiment at Brookhaven using muons. You just circulate them, and they live a long time when they're going fast, and you look at the whether the decay is exactly 2 like the Dirac moment, or whether it's shifted a little bit. And it was found that there's a shift of about 4 standard deviations from the standard model, from the Brookhaven number. So that's the only known deviation from the standard model. People say 4 standard deviations is not so big, but in fact, for a precision measurement, it's very big. The experiment's being repeated now at Fermilab and in Japan. The supersymmetry explanation of it involves putting sleptons, muons, in a loop and having particles emit photons to see a magnetic moment. If the Brookhaven number stands up, there's no way I know of to explain it in a compactified supersymmetric, compactified string theory. People have looked at ways to explain it, tried to make models that are simply different from some outside contribution. They've written some down, my knowledge, they're all excluded somehow, but I haven't really finished examining that with a student yet. But the report should come from Fermilab maybe by end of summer or fall. They're supposed to be unblinding their experiment, and if it goes back to the standard model value when it's measured at Fermilab or J-PARC in Japan, that's a huge triumph for the compactified theory. If it doesn't, it might be a problem, but it has to be checked whether there could be other contributions that haven't been found yet from hidden sectors, for example, where people are looking. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Could you go back to the description of these hidden sectors, where they come from?
I didn't have a very clear
different possible vacua, or what is it?
Do you mean description?
The G2 manifold might have lots of codimension four singularities which don't intersect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically, and so the standard model would be, which is called, usually called the visible sector, in the standard in one.
And
along the lines of what Jim Halverson was looking at, when he had this huge number, and he's looking at all these RBL fourfolds, 10 to the 700 or whatever it was, and he was finding that on average there's something like 700 hidden sectors, you know,
time to comment on this G-2, which is kind of has back relation with G2 Halonen by the NAC minus. But I would not say that kind of, well, you know, it's clearly a very interesting problem. Comment is that theoretical accuracy of, say, hadronic contribution to G-2 is not that great. So, in this sense, one of possible, no, first of all, interesting, of course, whether they will, you know, indeed keep this deviation. But the other point is that theoretical understanding of hadronic contribution, like by light into G-2, is not the one which would exclude, you know, possibility that yeah. Something could happen.
So. This is a good comment and important to pay attention to. What I'm basically, what I've turned into when looking at it is that people have been studying exactly those questions and a large number of smart people for 10 years, and they can't find any way to change that prediction.
I was thinking of the
company of the papers that, yeah. Papers that were. Well, if you've got a way, I would like to know. You tell them, give me a reference.
Certain by that.
No, well, I'm.
You know, there's talk about measuring polarization at VEP and so forth, but it's not been done to the accuracy needed.
So, but what I'm basically saying is after a long time, people have examined any ways that it can change, and it's less looking less and less likely. Well, I hope you're right. And that it goes back, and there's no other problem. But I've become more convinced that it's a serious issue. But I can learn about that still.
Other questions or comments?
Can you say a little bit more about the specific signatures for the inflationary model you had?
nothing useful because you make the standard predictions for R, the tensor ratio and the tilt is 0.97, and you get those things right, and you don't disagree with any of the astrophysics predictions, non-Gaussianities and so forth. So if there were very small effects discovered, one could work hard and try and calculate them, but there are no dramatic effects. And we wish there were. I mean, we tried to look the initial, yeah.
I think there could be. I think there could be, because if you've got lots of hidden sectors and then the inflaton is, you know, it's a high scale inflation model, some of the hidden sectors will undergo first order phase transitions during inflation, for example, and, you know, between the end of inflation and now. So you could, with those high scales, you could produce primordial gravitational waves from hidden sector phase transitions hidden sectors.
I agree with that, yes. And you get gravitational waves, tests for which can be done in 20 years. So I wasn't thinking seriously about that as a test in the foreseeable future, my foreseeable future.
You gotta hang around for it.
I repeatedly have been told that I must hang around till super partners are found. So it's okay with me. Yeah, I that's correct. And we didn't calculate those, but they could be. And I wish eventually it could be interesting.
You pointed out that the mass of the three hub,
Gravitino?
Yeah, it's large during the inflation and then it goes down as you go through. Is there a mechanism to describe this? A precise mechanism to describe this?
In the paper we wrote, it tells exactly what that is.
It's just that diagram.
It's that diagram.
The field goes from one region of the potential, where the masses are high, and then in the end it ends up in the vacuum, where the mass is low.
Think about where
the potential itself is.
Look,
but you don't know how to calculate that potential.
Yeah, we do. We calculated that curve. We do know how to calculate that. Thank you for the opportunity to emphasize that. That curve, in the paper, we write a list of moduli that form the inflaton, and they're basically the ones that, when combined, look like the overall shape of the volume of the region. And then this is a numerical calculation of the potential energy of that set, literally. And that's the flat region that, when you hear people talk about inflation having a flat region, that's it. And we calculate numerically that you get about the right number of E-foldings and that it behaves about right. And this is a special one in the sense that there's an inflection point, which not all inflationary potentials have. So some stuff goes with that, but again, it's the standard stuff for things that are far away, as far as I know. So unfortunately, I don't know. There's a little bit of argument that maybe from the decays of the moduli, as inflation ends, we can do some cosmology and get something. And there's been speculation about that by cosmologists for other things that we can maybe take over. But I don't, it looks hard. So you just have to believe it.
More questions? Let's thank Cody again.